Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Adam Pelsman, an old friend of the show and of our bookshop. We last spoke after the publication of his first novel, Troika, after which he came to Philly, where he also went to the University of Pennsylvania. He read and signed at the shop, and, you know, we got to know each other. So all in all, it's been a pleasure working with Adam these past few years. He's a lawyer, as am I, and he's worked in the financial and private equity world for many years. None of that has anything to do with writing, nor the fact that Adam may have about 7 unpublished novels sitting in the bottom drawer of his dresser at home. That might not be quite accurate, but we'll talk about it. In any event, let's talk a little bit about his latest work, The Papaya King, which is published in July by Jackson Heights Press. So don't get me wrong here. Troika was a great book, and we all loved it, but this one is incredible. It cannot be read in more than one sitting. It deals with a subject that's so arcane, so zany, so weird, but so germane that I doubt they will see its like again. The closest I can come is A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole, My Brother's in My Favorite Book, which is why my brother now has a copy of this one. It's really a throwback in time to when decency and civility existed, kind of like the way Mark Halperin would like it to exist, although not in as Republican a way. But I don't want to get started on that. So Robert Walser is a conundrum, an enigma wrapped in a riddle. We respect him for his gravitas, his demeanor, his sartorial attention, his devotion as Dante is to his Beatrice, as Kafka in a way is to Felice and Florentina and Fermina in Love of the Time of Cholera. Anyway, that's his love affair. So, okay, I'll stop there before I go off on one of my many tangled tangents. Oh, yeah, but Robert is also he's a fop, a dilettante, a coward of sorts, and a fool. So basically, you can't put everything together. He's kind of a little like most of us. So why are we so attracted to him? Is it because of that similarity, or is it because it harkens back again to Halperin and Winter's Tale, another favorite of mine and my brother's, and one that's as in love with New York City as this book? So all of these things, and before I start to explain them myself in an inherently incoherent fashion, let me introduce my friend, entrepreneur, and author of Tales of Love, Intrigue, and Imagination. Hi, Adam. Thanks so much for coming to see us again.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So who is this guy?
Robert Walser. Let me first start off by saying that the character in the story was inspired by the Swiss writer Robert Walser, who wrote in the early part of the 20th century, and he wrote a book called The Walk, which is about an outsider who is walking around his village and making observations. And this book, The Papaya King, started out as, in effect, an homage to Robert Walser's The Walk. So that's why the protagonist and narrator in the story is called Robert Walser. Robert Walser is a peculiar fellow. He's in his early 30s. He lives in New York City on the Upper West Side. And he has a very genteel, old-fashioned way about him, both in terms of how he speaks, in terms of how he dresses, in terms of how he interacts with the world around him. He's a struggling writer. He is someone who cannot connect with people despite his best intentions. He is a stranger in a strange land, if you will. He's a man of a different time. And as a result of his disconnection from the world around him, he gets involved in all sorts of conflicts and misunderstandings that help guide him and form his frustration with modern society.
Well, it's funny, you know, we were talking a little bit before the show started, and one of the stories you were saying was germane to the fact that you kind of live in the area that Robert loves, and you also have some of the same opinions that Robert has. And, you know, I always ask this to everybody about whether it's autobiographical or not. But it does seem like, and when I was saying you really found your voice this time, it does seem like there's a lot of things that resonate with you that resonate with him as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. I probably have a very different sensibility than this narrator. But the book takes place mostly, almost exclusively, in the neighborhood in which I live, which is the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And I've lived here for over two decades, and I've walked the streets, and I've observed, you know, the changing of the neighborhood, the different types of shops that have come in over the last 20 years. I've seen the different types of businesses come in and out. And I've been an observer like Robert Walser has been. And so many of the observations in the book, everything relating to the chain mattress store, which is competing against the family-owned mattress store, to the restaurants, to the hardware store, to the papaya and hot dog store, which is in our neighborhood, are all formed by my experiences as I've lived here.
Is there a Stavros?
There's not a Stavros, but there is a restaurant which, similar to the way it's presented in the book, never seems to be open when a restaurant should be open, to my great astonishment. And I've actually gone in there a couple of times over the years, and I've eaten there, and I've never been able to figure out why it has these bizarre operating hours. So the restaurant, there's a hint of the restaurant in reality, but I have not met Stavros.
It's funny. It's like my girlfriend and I went to this wedding in the Poconos, of all places, this past weekend. And I always drive, but I just started the book, and I asked her if she would drive home so I could read it. And it's great that I can read in the car, because it's like wonderful. And so I'm reading the book, and I really irritated her because I kept laughing out loud the whole way home, and she just was driving her crazy. But there's so many things, like there's an incident, you know, you can't really, there's no real spoilers in this book, so I can talk about it, but there's an incident, you know, where his neighbor dies, and he takes control, or he takes care of her hamster. But rather than me telling it, tell just that story discreetly, because, you know, it's all about Robert. But then I thought, you know what? There are so many. First, I thought, okay, this book is just about him. And then I realized, and I'll do this today, that there are so many great peripheral characters, several of them animals. But tell the hamster story, because it's really good. And what happens?
So the hamster story is actually based on reality. So in the book, Robert Walser is tasked with caring for the hamster of a neighbor who has died, and this hamster begins to sort of represent things for him beyond just a pet. He's caring for this beloved creature, and he's mourning the death of this neighbor, and the hamster is ailing, and so he takes the hamster to a veterinarian in New York, and the veterinarian tells them, we can't treat this hamster. You have to go to a veterinarian who treats exotic pets. And this is based on a true experience that I had with my son. My son is about 5 years old, and he had a hamster, and the hamster was quite sick. And I brought the hamster to the local veterinarian, and they said, you've got to take this hamster to an exotic pet vet, which stunned me, because the hamster cost $4 at the local pet store. When I think of an exotic pet, I'm thinking of a cockatoo or some type of exotic lizard. I'm not thinking of a hamster. So I ended up taking the hamster over to the exotic pet vet, which was around the corner, and they had parrots and all sorts of stuff. And the veterinarian examined the hamster and said, it's gravely ill, and we can do a couple of things. We can essentially admit the hamster into this veterinary practice, and we can monitor the hamster's vital signs for several days, or we can And even then, it would not likely live very long. Or we can euthanize the hamster. And so it was gravely ill. It wasn't going to survive. And I took the euthanasia route. And they presented me with a bill for the euthanasia that exceeded by orders of magnitude the cost of the hamster. I don't remember the exact number, but I think it was at least $100 to euthanize a hamster. And because I had a five-year-old and this was my first time having to go through the death of a pet with a child, I just bit the bullet and paid the money. And I remember walking away from this thinking, wow, this is a quintessentially New York experience. Like, can you imagine telling someone else outside of, you know, a major metropolitan area in the United States that you just spent $100 to euthanize a hamster? They look at you like you're crazy. And it was crazy. It was an insane thing, right? And so that experience stuck with me, and I sort of vowed at that time, if I ever have an opportunity to insert that scene into a novel, I'm going to do it. And I think it fit nicely into Robert Walser's struggle and his own sort of personality.
Yeah, and then the extrapolation of that story is so heartbreaking. What happened? Well, go ahead, tell that too, because you know you can tell any story.
Yeah, so he's got the hamster, and he pays a lot of money to put it in some type of a fancy mahogany type box, and he's walking through the streets, and he feels that he's honored both the hamster and his neighbor who died. He feels that he's honored both of their legacies. And he's mugged. He's attacked by a group of young kids who knock him to the ground and steal his hamster urn and run off into the distance with it. And he is left crestfallen and heartbroken by this.
And also, partially because of this, you know, he has this inherent fear and disgust towards rats. But so tell what happens with the rat that died. You know, tell that story. Because it just continues.
Yeah, he's got a fear of he's a generally sort of nervous character, and he's got a pathological fear of rats, and he's walking down the street one day, and he's walking past a bunch of garbage bags, and he's terrified that a rat is going to jump out from the trash heap, which is not uncommon in the city these days, and sure enough, one jumps out. It gets up on its hind feet and it looks at him in sort of a fierce way, and he's startled and he gasps, and instantaneously a truck runs by and runs over the rat and kills it. And again, he's horrified that this creature that he loathed just moments ago and feared just moments ago has died, and his true sensitivity for all living things comes out, and he tries to look after this now dead creature.
And he takes his handkerchief out and
that's right.
Covers him.
That's right.
Requiem. It's funny because the first time I was down in Chinatown, and I was with my friend who was a native New Yorker, and we were outside the restaurant, and there are all the bags of trash, and he goes, "Watch that bag for a second." And then the bag starts moving and wriggling, and I'm thinking, "What the hell is that?" And he says, "There's just, it's the rats, they're inside there." And I thought, that's absolutely disgusting, but also amazing at the same time.
But, yep, city living.
Yeah. So anyway, so talking about characters, I guess first, if I go deductively, Robert's father, Kingsley, and what you do again, and this, you know, every time you did it, I laughed out loud. Kingsley is a war hero, physicist, minor league baseball player, distinguished professor, and writer who was shortlisted for several prestigious awards. And how many times do you think you say that in the book?
You know, I don't know. I probably said it, I'd have to go back and check, but it's probably at least five times, maybe more. I don't know.
I did. I had it on my iPad, so I checked.
Oh,
it's like seven. It's like seven.
Seven. Yeah. I did that on purpose. I wanted to keep driving that home because it was in some way torturing the character. You know, that's one of the themes here is you have someone who could never live up to the greatness of his father, and his inability to do so really crippled him. It destroyed his confidence. It destroyed his sense of agency in the world, and he exists in a near constant state of deficit because of that comparison that he always makes to his father.
And, you know, it's funny because as much as I laugh throughout the book, the Kingsley and Robert's mother, when you look at the way they're portrayed and the way they talk, especially his father, I really like the advice he gave his son. And his mother, notwithstanding what happened, you know, was also, she was always going to be there, maybe in a little kind of too much of a way. But that harkened back to Troika to me. I mean, that was like going back to like your, not roots, going back to a different type of writing. So every once in a while you'd put that in there, which like would stop you because then you'd think, oh, this is really a real story about a real person. And
there was a balance here, right? So part of it is telling a what I hope is a humorous, entertaining, funny story about an outsider, an oddball outsider, and his interaction with the world and all the follies that ensue, but also trying to layer in what I think are, what I hope are some important themes. And those themes are about an aggressive sort of modern society that we live in, especially in cities. We're living in a world that's driven by technology, increased economic cost. There's a certain urban velocity that we're dealing with. And what this causes is a lot of people, it makes them live in a state of near constant vigilance, fear, anxiety, people who are sort of lacking in any kind of real psychic nourishment. And so I was trying to address that modern urban experience for this character. And it also deals with, as you noted, it deals with childhood traumas. It deals with parents who, for any number of reasons, weren't able to be there for a child and how that impacts that child's development. And it deals also with technology. There's an element to the book that also deals with these sort of pernicious effects of technology and artificial intelligence and the use of personal information. So it was a difficult balance in trying to create humor and also address some themes that at least were important to me that I wanted to convey in the book.
Yeah, and it's funny because, again, it's a relatively short novel, but it's like a portmanteau book. You shove all this stuff into it, like I was talking about, this epistolary romance with Rose. And it's really funny because I was down on Broad Street, which you know, and at, I think it was at the Doubletree. Maybe it was at, it might have been at the Bellevue, but they were having a steampunk festival. And there was someone there who then later, when I read the book, was dressed exactly like Rose was dressed. And so talk a little bit about, well, you never really say how it starts. I don't know if it started on Tinder, if it started on some site, but talk a little bit about the relationship between Robert and Rose. And, you know, in the beginning, I'm thinking, no, she's just taking him for a ride, but she wasn't. So talk a little bit about that.
So we don't know for sure if Rose is going to exist. But what we know in the early stages of the book is that he receives a letter from a woman named Rose, and we learn that he's been carrying on a romantic, and I put romantic in quotation marks, a romantic relationship with a woman named Rose from Philadelphia. What we also learn is that he's never met Rose before. And in the opening scenes of the book, he goes down to the Port Authority to meet Rose. She's supposed to be getting off a bus, and to his great disappointment and sadness, she doesn't get off the bus. She doesn't show up. And then we learn that this has happened several times before, and he's never met her, and he's never heard her voice. And we're wondering, or the reader is wondering, if Rose even exists. Is Robert Walser insane? Is he having delusions? Is he the victim of some type of catfishing type of thing here, where he's being lured into a relationship under false pretenses, and he's going to be taken advantage of? We just don't know. And one of the things that we learn about Rose through this relationship, this epistolary relationship that he has with Rose, is that she is a member of what's called the steampunk community. And the steampunk is sort of a sub-genre of folks who have a visual aesthetic and an aesthetic in terms of their attire that has elements of both the past and sort of the future. So they might wear like an old prairie skirt or a Victorian dress, and then at the same time they might have a Buck Rogers laser gun or some type of peculiar sort of futuristic accessory that goes along with their old aesthetic. And this issue that attracted me to this steampunk concept, because it deals with both the past and the future. And this character, Robert Walzer, is really stuck in the past. So one of the things that this book is examining is, where do we live? Do we live in the past, do we live in the present, or do we live in the future? And that's why this relationship between the two, I felt, was sort of intriguing.
And it's funny because I was kind of saying, hey, Adam, because then when you have Rose start talking, you know, and I've lived in Philadelphia all my life, so, and I'm thinking, I don't talk like that. Because you have her speaking like she's from South Philly, and I'm thinking, no, I don't have an accent like that.
I did go with the South Philly accent, right? And I'm sure some people from South Philly will be offended by this, but that was what I was attempting to recreate.
Yeah, it was good. It's funny, too, parenthetically, about, and this goes back again to Winter's Tale, is like, you know, you like, and we talked about this last time, and you kind of like the idea of talking about, you love New York, and you like talking about, like, how disgusting the Port Authority is, which it is, and Penn Station. 30th Street Station is bad, but that statue, I've spent a lot of time in front of that statue. And, but you don't, like Mark Halperin, even on the cover of Winter's Tale, talk about Grand Central, which is, you know, completely different. And I kind of wondered why you didn't mention Grand Central. Maybe you just wanted to keep
I guess I wanted it. I wanted to give a narrator something to complain about.
Right.
And you're right. Grand Central is stunning. It's magnificent. And now he does make some reference to not Grand Central, but he does make reference to some of the other great terminals in the world, St. Pancras in London, Gare du Nord in Paris. He talks about Kazansky Station. So he does give some credit to some of the great architectural accomplishments in terms of transportation, but I wanted to give him a place where he could look in absolute disgust at what was around him, and also probably give me a forum for my disgust at the Port Authority and Penn Station. It's just incredible to me that that's what we have, but
And like I said, I mean, there's so much stuff. I marvel at the fact that, you know, it is such a semi-slim volume, and then because I could go on forever with all these guys. But anyway, so there's Stavros, who owns the restaurant that isn't open at lunchtime, and then you have the Turk, Barber, and then you have this whole little story about how they kind of despise each other. They despise the gay movement and the multicolored flag, which Robert has no idea what it is. And but then how did you come up with the idea that all of a sudden they become friends? And
I just thought, you know, you have a Turk and a Greek, and I have a little bit of experience on one side of my family is Greek, so I have a little bit of an insight into the culture. And it just struck me as we have got all these sort of bizarre and sort of nonsensical feuds and disputes in the world, and the Turks and the Greeks is one of them. And I thought, you know, we can talk. The barber is Turkish, but he's from Cyprus, and you know, it just struck me as a potentially funny scene where you could have two people who are so sort of philosophically and culturally different and really dislike each other, and then come together and realize that they actually like each other, which seems to be the most normal way things should work.
Yeah, and then when Robert comes in, and Barbara's really irritated that he's even in there. it's well, the other thing is, and this is semi-inappropriate for both of us, I guess, but you know, what happens to Robert after his initial luncheon at the unnamed Popeye and hot dog shop, that's happened to me. Has that ever happened to you?
It has. I have had my... So what happens is Robert Walzer, there's a Popeye and hot dog stand, and he's always viewed it with a certain amount of skepticism because it doesn't really match up with his very genteel way of living. But he's intrigued by it, and there's a pull. There's a part of him that wants to be like everybody else. He wants to be a normal person. So he goes into this shop, and he eats the hot dog, and he knocks down a tall glass of papaya juice, and within minutes he's in gastrointestinal agony, and he's running back to his apartment for some type of relief. So has that happened to me? I'm sure it has.
Well, then the other thing is, and another character is Ivan Polsky. First of all, how'd you name him that? Because is he a guy you know?
He's not a guy. So Polsky is a professor at Columbia, and he's a very pompous, arrogant, condescending guy. And he's not modeled on any particular person I know. He's sort of an amalgamation of different people that I've met over the years in academia. And Polsky, the name, again, that's not based on anything. It just struck me as it's sort of a funny name, Polsky, right?
Yeah.
Especially for that kind of guy. And Robert Walzer just refers to him as Polsky in this very sort of disparaging way. So he's one of the least likable people, one of the least likable characters in the book. But he's one of my favorite characters just because he's so repugnant.
And it's so funny, you know, just one, calling him Bobby and then stepping on his hat and then meeting him when he's in this distress and saying, "You don't look so well." And it's just, and this is, you know, I'm seriously laughing out loud the whole time. And it's just like, you know, I thought.
Polsky shows up everywhere. Like every time and Robert Walzer has a problem, every time he's in distress, every time his stomach hurts, every time he's in some type of agony, Polsky just shows up in the neighborhood, essentially reminding Robert Walzer of how pathetic he is and how far he has to go before he can be the kind of man that his own father was. So Polsky is a reminder, a constant reminder to Robert Walzer of his own deficiencies.
And then yet there is a slight metamorphosis when we get to the climactic scene in the book, but I want to talk about that at the end. So what about Belinda St. Clair? Where does she come from? Is without getting a little too, you know, close to what's going on in your life.
Yeah, but Belinda is the agent of Robert Walzer. She's a literary agent, and Robert Walzer is not a successful writer, and so he's very fortunate to have an agent. And this woman, for whatever reason, sees something in Robert Walzer that she feels very protective of him, right? She's trying to support his literary career, even though she knows she's never going to make any money off of anything that the guy ever writes. She's frustrated with the fact that he is not employed and he's not earning a wage that enables him to support himself and to also focus more on his writing. She sets him up on a job interview. She tries to get him a job. She sets him up with an interview at an advertising agency with her nephew. That turns into a complete disaster. But to her great credit, she's gruff. She's direct. She's a little impatient, but she really cares about this guy, and she's one of the few advocates that he has in his life.
And the only thing she gets him is this literary magazine in the Midwest. No, it's in Canada, right?
Yeah, it's in Saskatchewan.
Of course it is. And he's going to get like maybe $400 and then it goes bankrupt. And it's, I still marvel, like I said. It's like there's so many different scenes in here revolving, you know, around this one guy. And I guess, I could go on forever, but I guess to end it, let's talk about, obviously, which is the pivotal thing, as much as you want to talk about it, and I want to know how you named it too, because I can't find it anywhere, is hashtag Dunamisto.
Yeah. Yeah, so without giving away the ending, there is in his neighborhood, which is, so he lives on 72nd and West End. He walks along 72nd Street towards the park with some regularity, and he passes a subway plaza at 72nd and Broadway. There's a subway stop there. And being erected in this plaza is an enormous sculpture that looks at first like an inverted Y. Sort of is described as a body with no arms or head. And it's made out of metal, and it's thick, and it's ominous, and it's sort of brutalistic in its presentation. And this sculpture is called Dunamisto. And Dunamisto is a combination of Duna and Misto, which means power and mixed, so like the sort of mixed, mutated power. And the hashtag, I think, was just a tip of the hat to the fact that there's a technology aspect to it and how that hashtag is used in the way we communicate in our lives these days. And this sculpture is being erected in this plaza, and he reads the narrative about it at the work site, and it says that it's being sponsored, or the creation of this is being sponsored by the Museum of Contemporary Art, the Department of Defense, and an anonymous corporate donor. And to me, that was, what I was trying to capture here is that we now have this sort of confluence, especially between the arts and commerce, where art is becoming more commercialized and more corporate in nature and more focused on economics and profit, and also this confluence between corporate America and our defense structure as well, and that you've got this, for lack of a better word, troika of these three different forces in our society that are coming together to create this. And he hates this thing because it represents everything that he loathes about modern society. And one of the things that this sculpture does is it claims to be able to read into the essence of a human being with very little information available to it.
And, you know, it's...
And this begins a Don Quixote-esque rage that he has at this sculpture, it becomes a symbol of everything that he hates about modern society.
And it's funny because I always talk about this with every author, but this is paradoxical for me. But, and again, without giving anything away, if I can do this, sometimes, like in Troika, you're not quite sure in Troika at the end what exactly is going to happen in the future. And so as a reader, you can kind of go off on your own tangent and say, I wonder if this is going to work out between, I wonder what's going to happen. Is this going to be something that they can handle, they can hang on to? But here, it's like, it's the ending you want. And everything, the reader, normally I wouldn't want this, but it's this one, it works perfectly because it's like, this is what you want to happen. Is that giving away too much?
Well, what I would say is you're right about Troika. It was left open at the end on purpose. And that was in part because I didn't really know how it was going to end. And I didn't want the reader to know how it was going to end either. I wanted the reader to be able to sort of extrapolate and make their own judgments about what happens next. In this book, I really wanted to bring everything together. I wanted to tie up every loose end, and I wanted there to be a satisfying conclusion to the book that related to that helped bring together all the different threads. And the threads are a relationship with a woman who may not exist, an ongoing battle with a symbol of modern society that he loathes, and also a personal empowerment, a change in the way that he thinks, the way he feels, the way he interacts in the world. I wanted him to be able to change into something that he wasn't before, that we that I hope the reader would want for him. So yeah, it was done on purpose. I wanted there to be a satisfying resolution to this.
Yeah, and it's funny because once again, Polsky's there.
Polsky's everywhere. Polsky's at the end. You know, he shows up at a moment that could be Robert Walzer's greatest humiliation, or it could be his triumph, and Polsky's there again.
Polsky's there.
And here's the thing: we all have our own Polsky, right? We all have that that one person that always seems to remind us of how ineffectual we are, and very often, you know, we no one else knows that that person knows our Polsky, but we all have that one person that makes us feel a little less than what we should feel.
Yeah, and unfortunately, well, this happened last night. I mean, there's this guy. I don't want him to know this, but there's this guy that, like, he's one of those guys that starts talking, doesn't listen to anything, but just talks and talks and talks. And what I do at the bookstore is I have one of my employees call me up on my cell phone, and then I can say, "Oh, I got to take this call," and that's the only way I can get rid of him. Some of the other ones that are like that, I say, okay, you have 3 minutes, that's all you have, and we're done. And they're pretty good at taking that. But this guy, last night, another guy was doing exactly the same thing. And so the guy he was talking to, I said, hey, let me talk to you for a minute. And when he came over, I said, I'm just doing this so I can get you away from this guy. But then my guy comes over to him and starts doing it. And me being, you know a little bit about me by now, me being who I am, I went over and I said, do you realize you're doing exactly what the guy before you was doing? And he goes, thanks a lot, Sam. I can see you haven't changed in the past few years.
So if in the course of this interview, if you quickly suddenly get a call from your employees and then end the interview, should I make the same assumption?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, definitely. So far, it's been, well, it was really bad yesterday because there was one woman on one side. When I practiced law, I always had an escape hatch. I had a back door. In the bookstore, I don't have a back door. I can't get out. So there was one woman doing this on one side and this other guy doing it. And so I had Angie call me so I could get past the lesser of the two evils. And as I'm going by, he starts to grab me by the arm to actually stop me. And the phone rings just at that moment. So I was able to extricate myself.
Extract yourself, yeah.
Yeah. it's kind of like an episode of Seinfeld. My bookstore is like Seinfeld. It's exactly like Seinfeld. Yeah. But so to end this, and then we can talk a little bit afterwards. But so what do you think? Do you think this is like a one-off, or do you think, like, it's so cool? And it's, what do you think?
Yeah, so I don't know what to think. What I've written is a book that I'm really proud of. I feel that in many ways it's a stronger book than Troika. My guess is, well, I shouldn't say this. My instinct is that it probably doesn't have the commercial appeal that Troika might have. But it's a book that I feel sort of represents whatever talents I have and addresses what I think are some really important issues. And it's not clear to me what the future of this book will hold. As a writer, you're pretty much, you're grateful if it gets into the hands of anyone to read it. So if it ends up being sort of a book that I'm proud of, that gets into the hands of a few hundred people and is read by them and resonates with even just a few of them, then I will consider it a success. But it's not clear to me where it goes from here.
Yeah, well, like we talked about, I'll get you at least halfway there. And
thank you.
My brother is going to go berserk when he reads this. And my friend who lives on 72nd Street, Bernie Masner, this calligrapher, best calligrapher in the world, He'll go berserk when he reads it too, because he walks the same walk that you do.
He'll
know you're a little village kind of thing, and I have like 10 people I can think of just off the top of my head that I'm gonna give it to, but it's already in the store and it's sitting at the front table, and the cool thing about you is, you know, it's nice that you'll come and talk, or we can just, you can come and we can have a drink and talk about whatever.
but it's nice that you come back down to Philly because you spent a lot of time here, and I know you like it here too. So
yeah, I love Philadelphia and love your store, and happy to come down at any time.
Okay, all right. Well, thanks a lot. We were talking with Adam Pelsman, hopefully a good friend of mine now. His first book was Troika. He came down to the bookstore. Ron here at the studio says I need to plug my bookstore more. So Wellington Square Bookshop, it's just off Route 100, past the Downingtown Interchange of the Turnpike, in Eagleview, in the town center in Eagleview, where there's lots and lots of different stores. You can find Wellington Square Bookshop there. We were voted this year best of the main line, best in Pennsylvania, best in Philadelphia, and one of the 62 best bookstores in the world. So go to WellingtonSquareBooks.com. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. And, so this book, The Papaya King, come by and get it. I'll give you the damn book. It's really, 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 really good. And let me check what Rebecca has coming up. But anyway, yeah. The first book, Troika, was really good, but this book is so funny. And it's, like I said, pretty short. And you can read it in one sitting, and you should. So anyway, so let's see. We got coming up Adrienne Brudar, who's going to discuss her memoir, which is weird, Wild Game, My Mother, Her Lover, and Me. And then, as I said, I think in the last show, Orson Scott Card, the guy who wrote Ender's Game, which is like one of the coolest books, great movie. And then I guess the trilogy is Ender's Game, Speaker for the Dead, and Xenocide. And now he has a new novel called Lost and Found, which is just going to be coming out at the time I interview him. So I'm really looking forward to that. He's like one of my heroes. It's a great book. Just like kind of like Neuromancer was when William Gibson wrote that. Kind of seminal and kind of predicts what has now happened some years after these books were written, a quarter of a century after they were written. So in any event, thanks for joining us today to listen to me and Adam talk. And hopefully you'll be back here next week for another edition of The Avid Reader.